As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman. And Bruce, we're going to talk a little bit about some college football spring games here in a second, but want to make sure people stick around because we've got a great guest later to talk about the NFL draft, which is, of course, later this week.
Yes, that is our old friend Peter Schrager. He is everywhere on TV now talking all things NFL. He's on NFL Network. He's our sideline guy on Big Fox.
And he's got a seven-round mock draft on FoxSports.com. So if we're going to talk draft, we want to talk to Peter. But first, did you watch the Alabama spring game on Saturday?
I did. I actually watched it twice, Stu. I was so into it.
No, you didn't.
Well, I watched it more than once, yeah, because it came on later and I was sitting and happened to have it on and it was just kind of, yes, it's lame. But I watched a lot of spring football this weekend. I think I watched a half dozen games and versions of probably nine in total.
I watched a bunch of them. DVR is the key to watching spring games because there's a lot of dead time in spring games. So if you DVR and watch it later, at least you can fast forward. But, you know, the Alabama, and people are going to say that, you know, oh, you're kissing up to Saban. But no, the Alabama spring game is about the best one to watch, not only because they're really good, but he takes it really seriously. You know, some of these are just kind of a glorified flag football game, but Alabama, he divides it up. I've talked to him about it. He feels like it's a dress rehearsal. It's the first chance to see some of these guys play in front of a big crowd, and they do get a big crowd at that thing. And what stood out Saturday is a couple of freshmen just made extremely impressive debuts.
Okay, so let me ask you right now. Tua Tagovailoa, who is a guy we talked about on one of the Audibles about a year ago, I think with Greg Biggins, early enrollee quarterback from Hawaii, big, big, strong arm. Obviously, Jalen Hurts had a terrific true freshman year. Stu, after seeing some of Tua's passes, are you going to create a quarterback controversy there? Are you going to go overboard and say this is more than just a spring game? You're in love with Tua?
Well, first of all, I mean, I texted you during it because I was like, well, holy cat, wow. It's rare that I can just see just the cannon on the guy that quickly. He was really impressive. Am I going to create a quarterback controversy? No, because it's not like Jalen Hurts then went out and was bad in that game. They both put up big numbers. They both looked really good on the deep ball. And that's exactly what you wanted to see from Jalen Hurts. That was the area he needed to get better at. I guess the question is, if we assume that Jalen Hurts will still be the starter this fall, if you really think Tua is this good, can they really afford to sit him on the bench for 2 years? At least 2 years.
Well, what are you going to do, play two quarterbacks?
Well, Saban has done that a little bit.
Can you think of an opportunity where a quarterback, as a freshman, and maybe this happened at Ohio State and to some degree, although the years were a little different in terms of their eligibility, but where a freshman was an all-league player at quarterback and then was overtaken by a younger guy. I mean, this isn't quite Davis Webb, Pat Mahomes, but I mean, is there any one example that kind of sounds like this?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of cases where they went back and forth, you know, where for instance, if Jalen Hurts struggles, everybody's going to want him to come in and vice versa. And in fact, Urban Meyer got into a little bit of juggling, although he was, none of those guys were true freshmen at the time. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, but I will say that, you know, Alabama, everybody says, oh, they never have, they're so great at everything, but they never have a great quarterback. Physically, at least, they got one.
What else you got on him? Any other love?
Well, I mean,
I'm waiting for you to give like to give one of these things that Teddy would turn into a headline. Saban's fool if he doesn't have make two of the starters.
No, but I mean, we should be clear in saying he was not the only one. He was not the only freshman star out there. He
also Saban did, by the way, point out that he kind of tried to stem this off the flow of it in his post game and said, hey, he had two series against the first team defense and he did three and out in both of them. So it was like, that's the danger, I think, sometimes of people reading too much into spring games. They see somebody light up the second or third team defense or run through them, and then all of a sudden they see a big stat line and the hype train goes out of the building.
Well, yeah, it's always hard. You know, I hate when they got first string going at second string. If you've got second string going at second string and the guy's really good, then yeah, it would stand to reason he's going to shred the second string defense. But the numbers get really padded when it's first string against second string. Fortunately, most coaches now want to see best against best. But a lot of those throws went to Jerry Jeudy. He's a five-star receiver. He was named the MVP of the game, five catches for 134 yards. As if Alabama doesn't already have enough really good running backs, Najee Harris comes in. He looks really good. Future looks bright in Alabama. The only negative I would say is, while you wanted to see all this great downfield passing, at some point, you have to say, wait a minute, their DBs keep getting shredded. Maybe their DBs aren't as good this year.
Yeah, and that's the fine line you get when it didn't. That was similar with a couple of weeks ago when Ohio State had their spring game.
Correct. Like, they finally got some good play from their receivers they've been looking for, but then at the same time, they're like, well, maybe losing three first-round defensive backs is going to have an effect. Okay, you watched 8 gazillion spring games. Let's not recap all of them, but what stood out to you?
You know, I can't say too much jumped out at me in any other place. I mean, Tua was kind of a buzz guy. I watched Penn State. I watched some of LSU. I'll say LSU. What stood out to me is a lot of times when spring games are on TV, especially if it's a new coordinator, doesn't try to show too much. You know,
Matt Canada
showed a lot of his motion and window dressing stuff was on display, and it's going to be. I'm very curious to see how it works. The one thing I will say is, and I'm right now holding to LSU 9-3. If they can win 9 games with Danny Etling at quarterback, especially considering they have a young group of receivers, then Matt Canada is going to be in line for some head coaching jobs at the end of 2017.
Well, I was just going to say, so I watched a lot of that game too, and you're right. Matt Canada did all the funky motion guys and all that stuff, but then when they actually snapped the ball, they didn't do much. And it wasn't just Danny Etling. I mean, none of those quarterbacks got them going. And even Darius Geis, who we know how good he is, couldn't really get going. So either
it's a patchwork offensive line that they have. They have a couple of starters sitting out this spring or who weren't on the spring game. So I think that was also a big factor, is just not being good enough on the O-line right now.
Well, and LSU's always really good on defense, and it would appear they probably are going to be again as well. One other one I wanted to note is Notre Dame. What was the thing Notre Dame was absolutely the worst at last year? Pass rush. They had no pass rush. But I remember being there in the preseason, and poor Brian Van Gorder, he was still the defensive coordinator then, was talking up a true freshman by the name of Dalen Hayes. And he's now a rising sophomore. He had a bunch of sacks in that game. Now, they were sacks where all you had to do was touch the quarterback. But nevertheless, he burst through the line. And I think he may be the kind of disruptive pass rusher that they've been looking for.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, take it with a grain of salt, but they could use it. And obviously, seeing their receivers step up more than just one guy would be a big help as well.
For somebody who watched so many spring games, you just keep, like, than poo-pooing them. You keep saying, oh, they're just a spring game.
Well, again, I think it's a – actually, what I get more out of the spring game a lot of times is listening to you know, I watched some of the Cal spring game, and our friend Yogi Roth was doing the game. I think JB Long, and they're spending a bunch of time with those coaching staffs going on. So it's almost like, you know, they give you a better feel for what the spring has been like than what you can encapsulate in maybe 2 hours of a scrimmage. So I think it's the broadcast, especially if it's one of these where they're talking about that program and not, you know, end up going way big picture about a bunch of other stuff that's not related to that team.
Can I give you a spring game broadcast pet peeve of mine?
Of course.
Like, and this was the case in a bunch of them, but I'm going to single out the Alabama one. They spend a bunch of time. No, it wasn't Alabama. Which one was it? I don't know. They all spent a bunch of time interviewing the former players on the sideline. Like, I get it. Spring games are not as exciting as regular games, and maybe you need to feel like you need to shake it up a little bit. But they'll go long sequences where all they're doing is talking to the former player on the sideline. And not even about anything interesting. It's like, well, you know, what do you think? Are they going to be good this year?
Was this the Penn State one that you were thinking of?
Yep. Yes, you're right. It was. It was the Penn State one on the Big Ten Network where they miss a touchdown, I think. They missed a really big play because he was interviewing somebody. But I also, on the Alabama one on ESPN, they had Reuben Foster. And this was Laura Rutledge. And I have nothing against Laura. She does a good job. But I don't know if she was under some sort of agreement or something, but she had Reuben Foster and she didn't ask him about the failed drug test.
Yeah, I think that's a tricky place to be, because a lot of times you think if you're doing that telecast, you're really catering mostly to the fans of that particular school, as opposed to certainly not the media, but fans from other places who probably are less interested.
I'm sure that's true for the ones on the Big Ten Network or the Pac-12 Network, but this was the main ESPN with Herb Street. I mean, our man Tess, did you hear how excited he got on that pick six at the line of scrimmage? You would think it just decided the national championship game.
Hey, listen, I've been on the phone with Tess when he's got his app on that can show him that, like, there's a delivery guy outside this house. He gets excited about that.
There you go. Hey, speaking of people who are really excited about life, Jim Harbaugh has taken his Michigan team to Italy. And I got to say, I didn't think much about it at the time that they announced this, other than, oh, yeah, it's the latest Jim Harbaugh gimmick. But now that it's here and you're seeing all these – and by the way, credit to all the Michigan, Detroit papers and media who have sent their writers to Italy for this. I didn't know that they would do that. Now that you're seeing the pictures and videos, I got to say, it's really cool.
So what do you like most about it? Because I'm sure there's going to be fans of everybody else and not Michigan who are going to get sick of hearing about Jim Harbaugh in Michigan on social media. And ESPN's got a crew out there following them as well. So it's going to be – I think that's probably – Jim Harbaugh loves the idea, hey, I'm going to be able to help – educate and bring my team closer together on this long trip to Europe, and also let them experience some things that, you know, it's part of the college experience if you have the wherewithal to do it. But also there's probably a back end of it, which is, hey, I'm going to probably get under a lot of people's skin in the process of doing this, and I don't have any problems with that either.
Honestly, I don't know why this – like, I understand he gets under my skin a lot too. I get sick of him on social media too, but this isn't him – at a high school game in California, or with his shirt off at a satellite camp, you know, just like the kind of non-news that we turn into news. Like,
oh, that's a media problem more than a Jim Harbaugh problem.
But that's why fans get sick of it.
Yeah, okay.
Like you said, this is a really, really kind of cool once-in-a-lifetime experience for these guys. I went to Rome once with my now wife, then girlfriend at the time. And, you know, they're doing all the same things we did. They're going to the Trevi Fountain, and they're making a wish, and you know, like all the, you know, going to all the, they're going to see the Vatican, obviously. And let's be honest, like, the school is paying for it. It's a very expensive thing to do. We did it when we were well into our respective careers. It's being a very hard thing for a typical 19, 20-year-old to do. So, and you also saw over the weekend where, and I don't really understand how they're getting special access to the Pope necessarily, but he had the players write an essay for why they should be one of the two chosen to shake his hand possibly, and it was really cool to read those essays. So all in all, it's just not to be totally cheesy, but this is what college is about. And you're going to see copycats, I would think. I would think you're going to see some other teams do something similar here in the coming years. All right, Bruce, we'll get back to the podcast in just a second, but we are thrilled to have back as our sponsor, Blue Apron. As you know, Bruce, not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference, so it's important to know where your food comes from. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free, plus free shipping, by going to blueapron.com/audible. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/audible.
Shifting gears to another story that got some significant attention over the weekend, Georgia had a four-star offensive line recruit who was a signee from the 2017 class. Deontay Demery, I believe that's how he pronounces his last name, got into some serious trouble over the weekend after the Georgia spring game. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to read from the story so we're accurate here. He was arrested late Saturday evening after his girlfriend, the mother of his one-month-old child, had called 911 and stated she wanted to press charges against him. Witness had corroborated her story to police that the two were in an argument, and when she tried to walk away, he pushed her, grabbed her by the neck, shoved her against the wall, and pulled her hair. The scuffle was broken up only for Demery to find her later when she claimed he threw her, damaging her glasses and her phone. Obviously this got a lot of attention, and Kirby Smart in Georgia basically cut him loose. What I was going to ask you is, and this move was applauded by a lot of people, the move of dumping him was applauded by Brenda Tracy, who's become a very prominent activist and has spoken at a lot of college football programs, including at Georgia, I believe, earlier in the week. And she said, just heard Kirby Smart release Demery. Good job, coach. Chalk this up as a win and a step towards changing the culture. I would agree with that. The question I would have for you, Stu, is, will you see it as much of a win as if some other school, especially a Power Five school, turns right around and scoops this guy up?
Okay, so that's going to be the thing to watch. I mean, first of all, you're right. We've made a lot of progress since Joe Mixon,
which is not a long. I mean,
well, you know, even more recently than that, right? I feel like it was right around this time a year ago, right, when the SEC went to Destin and Mississippi State announced that Jeffrey Simmons had been suspended for one game. And you wanted to like kind of beat your head against the wall and to say like, why aren't we making any progress here? So, and I want to be clear, like, I don't think you can necessarily say every single time, no matter what, no matter the details, if something like this comes up, guy has to be kicked off the team. I mean, I think you have to do it case by case and you have to look at the circumstances. This one seems pretty clear cut, right? There's a police report, there's witnesses. This doesn't seem like you could possibly, you know, misconstrue it as something else. So, yes, they made the right decision there. And we'll see what happens. I mean, there's any number of paths you can take from here. One would be to go the JUCO route. And then when that happens, and if he gets it through there without any trouble, then another school might be able to take him with a little less scrutiny. But I do believe, and I don't want to say this for sure without some sort of official ruling, but at least the way the rule was written by the SEC last year, I'm pretty sure he can now not transfer to another SEC school.
The only thing is, he wasn't enrolled yet. So he did sign a national letter of intent. I think this is up for interpretation at this point.
He can't go to Indiana.
Well, right? Indiana's not in the SEC.
No, I know, but they just literally announced a policy last week about you can't take a recruit with a history of sexual or domestic violence.
Yeah.
All right, actually, we have the clarification on this already from Seth Emerson, who covers Georgia for Dog Nation. He says, I've now confirmed that Demery cannot sign with another SEC school. There's been some confusion with this over the last 24 hours, but I've now confirmed that according to SEC transfer bylaws, he would have to sit out the next 2 years and not be on scholarship if he went anywhere within the SEC. He could go the JUCO route and go to another SEC school in 2 years. So it's I didn't know that. There's like a two-year window in here. According to the law, there is SEC schools are prevented from accepting a transfer student with a history of domestic or sexual violence. While it does not cover high school athletes, it's been confirmed now that because he signed a letter of intent and SEC financial aid agreement, he cannot receive a scholarship from another SEC program for 2 years. So there you go. There's your official clarification on that. So I do think if he's as good as the recruiting rankings say he is, he will end up at another FBS school at the very least, probably a Power 5 school, but he may have to go JUCO route in between.
Okay. I mean, at this point, you know, like, I think you would agree in second chances if that person shows they're contrite and they're trying to learn from the mistakes they've made. Again, I don't know if that means going away and sitting out a year while that's happening.
Michigan State had a situation also this past week where one of their players was dismissed for sexual assault accusations. But in this case, he had a complaint in high school, and D'Antonio signed him even in spite of that, but with conditions. And so he got in trouble. He's facing criminal charges. He got dismissed. And I don't want to say I called him out, but I noted that on Twitter. And of course, there was at least one Michigan State fan who said, "So you don't believe, you know, you should, if you have anything happen to you in high school, you should never be allowed to play college football." No, I don't believe that. I don't believe there are no second chances. But if you take that, if you're the coach and you take that risk, you know in doing so that if you get burned and if there's violence against a woman and on a campus where you chose to bring him to, you're going to feel criticism for that.
Yeah. And by the way, on regard to the story about the Georgia lineman, the precedent is a little interesting in that Georgia had obviously that player, Jonathan Taylor, which was part of that SEC rule that's now created. It was booted out of Georgia. Then Alabama took him, even after he'd been arrested of allegations of domestic violence. He actually did go to junior college in between. I think he went to Colin, which is in Mississippi, for a year. So I don't know if he graduated from that junior college.
The rule wasn't in place yet.
No, I know, but I'm saying, if that's the case, this would be kind of similar to that if another SEC school took him. Now, this guy would have played, I think, only played 1 year at Colin at a junior college, whereas, you know, you said, according to Seth Emerson's story, he would have to go 2 years, probably graduate from the junior college and get his associates, and then could be eligible to come back to the SEC.
Right. But the difference is Jonathan Taylor had already started his career at Georgia, right?
I don't know if the difference is that the other guy would have only gone to 1 year and he would have gone to 2 years. I don't know. I mean,
no, the difference is that if he were actually at Georgia, then he couldn't transfer.
You know, he got arrested in July. This guy got arrested earlier. I mean, I assume if you're a college football player in July, you probably have already enrolled in some kind of summer classes.
So basically the difference here in this rule, if you're actually playing for the school and get kicked out, then that's it. You can't play at another SEC school. In this case, he's still in high school, so he's not completely banned from going to another SEC school, but he'd have to wait 2 years.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying to you is the idea, I think the spirit of that SEC rule is they're saying, well, you have more experiences before this has happened. Like, it's almost like you should have known better. If you've already been in college, I think that's an odd gray area to make that distinction.
I get what you're saying.
I mean, because people tried to say, oh, when it came to Jeffrey Simmons, oh, well, he was younger. Jeffrey Simmons was like 19. It wasn't like, you know, he was older than a lot of college freshmen when he was, you know, caught on video beating up that woman.
I think, yeah, and I think with Jeffrey Simmons, when Scott Strickland, who was at Mississippi State then, is at Florida now, was defending it, it was in the whole, you know, should 30 seconds caught on video derail your whole life? And I think that there's still this the general sentiment is if the kid is still in high school, you feel less comfortable kind of cutting him off from that college opportunity altogether, whereas the kid who's already made it to college has maybe blown his opportunity. Does that sound right?
I think that's their thinking. I'm not sure if I, you know, buy that.
I'd want to research it a little bit more before I said whether I agree with that or not. I don't know if maybe there's been some studies done about if it happens in high school, does it happen again in college? But I can see the reasoning behind it, whether it's the right policy or not. We could debate. What do you say we get Peter Schrager on the line?
All right. Joining us now is our colleague, Mr. NFL Draft, Mr. All Things NFL, the great Peter Schrager. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
I feel like this is like an annual tradition we do this. I love being on the podcast, Kevin.
Well, we love reading the 7-round mock draft. Got to be the only seven, or at least the only credible 7-round mock draft on the internet, which went up on foxsports.com on Tuesday morning.
Tuesday morning, I had Jabril Peppers going in the first round. He fails a test at the combine. I'm scrambling Monday afternoon, calling teams. Is he off your board? Where do I put him? It's the most fluid thing in the world, but at some point you have to put it to bed. And yes, Jabril Peppers slips out of the first round, guys. I know you were losing sleep thinking about this, but I had him late first, and now I've got him early second. But that's the kind of stuff that happens in the days leading up to the draft. You do a 7-round mock draft. One guy gets a weird thing happen, whether it be Lyle Collins a few years ago or Tunzel last year, and suddenly the entire draft board is thrown into flux. It's amazing.
So I want to start at the bottom here for a second. When you go through to do a 7-round mock draft, a lot of people can have a top 50 or even a top 100. How big of a guessing game really is it when you get into round 7 and who needs what?
I mean, that's all. It's all a guessing game from round 5 on. But I'd say for the most part, I have all the guys tiered. And what that means is this guy's a round 1 tier. This guy's a round 2, round 3, round 4 tier. And that's from me polling and talking to GM since February at the combine, getting a sense where these guys are. Now, I'm going to call out a lot of other mock draft pundits. I don't have any value for someone saying, well, here's what I would do if I was the GM. Here's my mock draft. I don't know who that serves other than the person doing the mock draft. And I feel like it's almost an easy way out. And you see a lot of those online where it's, you know, there's no quarterbacks taken in the first round. Well, I don't see anyone worthy of taking a quarterback in the first round. Well, that's not how it works. There's going to be a quarterback taken in the first round. And really, you're doing nothing but covering your own ass. So for mine, I like to get as much intel as I can. And I've learned over the last few years, if I get this mock draft out there and it goes public, people start calling me and saying, what are you hearing? Why is that there? And it's almost like I'm being used as a conduit for a lot of different teams. And laugh if you want, but if I've got a guy in the second round and other teams have him as a 6th-round grade on their board, they're calling me and they're asking, well, someone must have told you that. What are you hearing and why is he all the way up in the second round? And the alternative, if I have someone in the 6th round, and, you know, some guys have them as a 2nd-round pick in their board, they'll call me and say, well, what do you know? What's the red flag there?
That's interesting. And Bruce and I have actually talked about that on here a lot, how I don't know that people understand that what certain draft pundits say, you know, in February, this is where a guy stands. You don't know that that's actually how people inside the teams feel. So I guess along those lines, I mean, of kind of the major, I won't make you call anybody out, but the major pundits, major media sites, how many do you think are basing it on those kind of calls as opposed to their own personal evaluations?
I think Mel Kiper does his based on what he's hearing around the league. I think every year Jay Glazer used to do one on the day. I think Peter King does one. I think these are the guys. If these people served as insiders during the year, during the 12 months leading up, and they're doing mock drafts, they're not all of a sudden putting on hats and saying, okay, well, I'm going to evaluate a guy I saw at the East-West Shrine Game. They're getting information from other people. Now, the guys who position themselves traditionally as scouts, I would say, you know, or even evaluators of talent, and I'm not, again, this is nothing negative, but when you have a, let's just go with Fox. Let's go Fox. Joel Klatt is going to do a mock, or maybe he won't do a mock draft, but I think he is going to do a mock draft the day of. By the time the draft is here, Joel is in tune enough with the NFL and college world where he'll have information guiding him. But I would argue that Joel's not, you know, calling up the Cincinnati Bengals the night before he does his mock draft, but rather he's saying, what fits here? What would I do? And what am I hearing, you know, secondhand almost on what makes sense here? So I use Joel as an example just because he's hours in-house. But you go around the dial, there's a lot of guys who position themselves as scouts and as, you know, draft experts based on they watch the film and here's my thought. and they're not trying to be insiders. So I think it's two different deals. And to Joel and Daniel Jeremiah's credit, they say, here's my top 50. I'm not attaching them to teams. Here are the top 50 players that I evaluated that I believe are the top 50 guys in this draft. And it's when you start attaching guys to teams and not knowing whether it's, you know, this is what I'm hearing, this is the gossip, or this is what makes sense based on needs and based on what I evaluate as a guy, where fans kind of get tripped up.
Having said all that, what is the incentive for teams to tell you, give you accurate information on where they, in other words, if they tell you such and such guy, we've got him on the board 20th, and other teams don't, what's their incentive to get that information out there? Don't they want to keep that to themselves?
This is relationship building, right, Stu? So I've known a GM for 10 years now, and I say, give me three names, like who are your top three guys? If the scenario played out this way, who'd you say? If he burns me and says, okay, well, we're going Solomon Thomas, when in truth it's Jonathan Allen, that's kind of an F you to me, right? And that's kind of a, hey, like what? Now, on the flip side of it, they're never going to say, here's who our pick is. It's set in stone. A lot of times they'll give me a couple names, say, we don't think highly of this guy, but let me tell you something. I'm hearing that Tennessee likes this guy, or I'm hearing that Carolina likes this guy. So a lot of it becomes secondhand. And just these scouts working with each other throughout the year, these general managers knowing each other for 10, 15 years and knowing what the other teams are doing. And they'll throw me those and say, okay, well, in our room right now, the scenario when we have the sixth pick and we're the Jets, we're saying here, the first pick, they're going to do this. Second pick, they're going to do that. Third pick. Well, how do you know that? Because that's just what we're hearing. And that's kind of the understanding in our room. And that's why it helps a lot of times. But Stu, to your point, very rarely is a guy going to flat out lie to me, because who, you know, if that's the case, and B, I'm getting a lot of information from other teams who are telling me, here's what we're hearing that they're doing. And sometimes you just got to take it on face value. And other times it's real. And it actually is real. And I think the track record shows, if myself, if Glazer, if Peter King are putting things out there, like I say, like Carolina likes Fournette, they also like McCaffrey. That's not smokescreen. I mean, it's not me throwing stuff against the wall. It's everyone around the league is hearing that. And personally, I've heard that. So it's always a delicate dance. You never want to be used by anyone. You never want to be lied to. You just got to hope that these guys aren't going to burn you.
How often is it a case where, and this is kind of in the same vein of the last question, there's a guy and it's a scout. I have a buddy who's an NFL scout. You know, and I remember we were walking somewhere in Indy and he ran into literally, first it was Mike G, then it was like two other media people. And I was like, wait a minute. And this is a guy I've known since he was in college, since he was at the college level. And I was like, you know, a lot of media people, you know, it kind of surprised me a little bit how many people I knew in the media that he was friendly with. And where it's somebody like that, who's definitely not a decision maker, and he's a guy that I will bounce stuff off of and, you know, and go to on some things over the course of the year. But like I said, he's not a decision maker. He could love or he could hate a player, yet ultimately he may not have much say so at all into the decision making process of that guy. How often do you get information or intel from somebody and you're like, all right, that's my buddy, I trust him on things, but really, you know, his team may go in a complete opposite direction or he says, yeah. So his information is only worth so much.
So look at it as like, this is a great conversation. It's almost like we're unveiling or we're pulling the curtain back. But Bruce, look at it as almost like an org chart, right? So the decision maker at the top is obviously the ideal person to get information from. From there, you've got your director of pro personnel, who is kind of the free agency guy. Then you got your director of college scouting. That's usually the second best person to get it from. If you have a coach, he knows the board. If you have an offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator, they know the boards. When you start getting into area scouts and regional scouts, they have their guys and they can fight the fight and they can tell you that I made a case for this guy. But the lower and lower you get down the org chart as your source, the lower and lower your chances are for accuracy on who they're going to take.
One of the
is this way too inside baseball?
No. I'm fascinated. I hope the listeners are as well.
Well, so one of the areas at the Combine, which is a hot spot of activity, we'll call it that, is Moe's, or what used to be Moe's, is a steakhouse where lots of media and agents and assistants and coaches gravitate. Now, I remember being in a conversation with a receivers coach this year about different guys they had interviewed. When I say interviewed, it's like, you know, whatever, the 15-minute window.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to me who they didn't even bother interviewing. There was a couple of really good college receivers. One, I would argue, was an outstanding college receiver. He was like, yeah, he's not even on our board. We didn't even waste the time. Like, it's 15 minutes. you know, and one of the players that they'd interviewed, who's a big time guy, and I would say is on a lot of those top 100 boards, he was like, yeah, I hated that kid. He was really disrespectful. You know, he gave us attitude and everything. And I remember thinking, okay, is this a reflection on the kid, or is this a kid going, you know what, I don't want that team to draft me, and I'm going to put out this signal so they know better. When you hear stuff like that, what do you usually, you know, what do you do with that kind of information?
I think I know who you're referring to, the player, because I've heard a lot of negatives about a guy, and I don't want to give the sniff off too much, who had a lot of success at the college ranks. It just isn't being talked about in the NFL draft. Like, he's available. He's on draft boards. Like, he's going to get drafted, but he is not in any of these conversations with Corey Davis and Mike Williams. And you're like, wait a second, this guy was better than all of them in college, and he's got the size. Like, why is he not? And it's, well, you know what? We just didn't like our meeting with him. That happens sometimes. But to the same thing, like, I remember, I don't want to name the name. I'm trying to think who it was. Last year, there was one of those deals where it was like, not on our board, terrible kid, bad person. And you're like, whoa, that's pretty harsh. And like, no, like, we've done, our security guys have done all the work on him. There's no one who speaks highly of him. And then he went in the first round. And you're like, all right, well, that team, I think very differently than the team that said that. So all you need is one. And I think they have these security guys doing the checks on him. And let's just, for example, because I'm going a little bit in a different direction with it, because let's go with all the offer field stuff. Let's go with the Reuben Foster stuff. So, you know, you've got teams who need linebackers, and they're going to do their work on Reuben Foster anyway. Now, say Reuben Foster slips out of the top 10. Say he starts slipping out of the top 15. Say he gets to number 20. Now you're talking to teams 20 to 32 who might not have invested all the time necessary to get a full check on Reuben Foster. They didn't think he was going to be available. They didn't do all the work. That's when you get your guy sliding into the second round, because it's, wait a second, we didn't expect him to be here. I'm not sure what I'm getting here. I don't trust what I have because I didn't put the time into it or the preparation. And now I need to make a decision, and I'm going to pass on a kid who we have been working on for 3 months that we've fallen in love with, that we love at pick 22, for example. That's the kind of interesting stuff with Jabril Peppers or Reuben Foster. And maybe with some of these kids that, you know, you meet at the combine, or you hear something from a guidance counselor at college and says, oh, he's bad, he misses practice, or he treats teammates crappy or something like that. That from the get-go, you took him off your board, but then suddenly you're sitting there in the third round and this kid is sitting there and you're like, oh gosh, you know, like, I wish we did spend a little more time. I wish we did meet him on the combine, because at this value, it makes a lot of sense. And maybe we have to pass on him because we just didn't do the work. And I think that happens a lot of times. And that's why you get these inevitable slides. A lot of times with guys who maybe off the field aren't candy stripers or gold stars.
Man, Pete, I'm starting to think that movie Draft Day was unrealistic. I could have sworn that that was exactly how it goes.
That's how it goes. The most unrealistic part of Draft Day is that the guys, the owner of the Browns, flew from Teterboro to Cleveland in like 12 minutes. It's just not possible. You can't do it. He got there way too fast.
Well, speaking of the owner of the Browns, I was going to ask you, you put in all this time, you make all these calls, you want to be as accurate as possible. And then, like, how do you – you can't account for the owner of the Browns says a homeless guy told him to draft Johnny Manziel the morning of the draft.
So what Stu is saying is you can't account for stupid. That's basically it.
Well, but in your experience, because I'm sure you then do the debrief, how often do these guys spend months and months scouting this to a science, and on draft day, the owner or the guy right below him makes an impulse decision?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's overrated. I think it doesn't happen as often as people think. You've heard the stories of – Jerry Jones apparently pounding his fist on the table to get Manziel, and the personnel guys, Will McClay specifically, is one of the guys in the front office saying, no, we're true to our board, and Zach Martin's the pick, and that worked out very well. Like, you hear those stories, then you hear the homeless guy with Manziel. The interesting one this year, the rumor that I heard, which is now probably not going to prove to be true, is that not a lot of teams in the NFL in the first round loved Jabril Peppers. Like, they didn't know where he fit, and he might be a lot of good, but not great at any position. But apparently, he's a Michigan man, and the Miami Dolphins owner, Stephen Ross,
the big Michigan guy,
school of business at Michigan, that, you know, when Jabril Peppers came to visit the Dolphins, Stephen Ross suddenly was like, let me meet him. Like, I want to meet him. I want to talk to him. So there was a lot of interest there that, you know, part of that might play into it. Maybe not. Like, we'll never know. If he's drafted by the Dolphins, clearly the owner was not against it. But you hear rumors like that where, you know, certain owners might want to play a bigger role than others. And especially when you get the red flag guy. So let's take Joe Mixon, right? Let's go with the opposite. Not like, hey, I want this guy. But what owner is going to have the appetite of risk to put up with or, you know, deal with the negative backlash that will inevitably come when Joe Mixon is drafted by a team? Some owners, just might not want to even deal with it. They might say it's just not worth it. The juice is not worth the squeeze. While other owners are saying, how good is he? What's his 40-yard dash? Can he help us win the Super Bowl? We'll put up with it. And a lot of that is the general manager trusting the appetite of the owner.
So in that spirit of making the big moves, who is somebody around the top 10 who you're probably either – your sources seem like they're higher on than other people or vice versa, where it's like you're a little bit of an outlier with your information or your insight on him?
Now, here's the guy that I think is an interesting X factor in this draft, because I'd never heard of him until the Senior Bowl, and I don't follow college football like you guys. I don't know college football like you guys. But Hassan Reddick out of Temple had a really good Senior Bowl.
How do you not, as my buddy, how do you not know that name? He was on our freaks list.
You've been a freaks. I know you were on the freaks thing. I know you've been on him.
He's one of the best stories in college football. He was a walk on. How do you,
I get it. He plays for Temple.
This is it. I mean, look, Bruce, I read your article. I used it as a reference point many times in the last 2 weeks. But I'll be honest, when you do your freaks list in August, I'm not thinking, oh, I got to go watch Temple football next Thursday night when they take on Seton Hall or whatever the hell they play. You know, that's not what it is. So I didn't see much of Matt Rhule's Temple Owls this year. Was he the coach? I assume so. I didn't see much Temple. But Hassan Reddick's name was not in many conversations, other than your article, of course. And maybe it's like he's going to be a combine workout warrior. But Senior Bowl, wowed everyone. Combine, people loved meeting with him. And now he's taking visits with teams. And it's like this yin and the yang of like Reuben Foster, great player at huge school and can hit and does all these things, has a terrible, terrible off the field resume. And there's Hassan Reddick, who might do all the same things and is one of the greatest kids you'll ever meet, with an unbelievable story of triumph and overcoming the odds. And there's talk that this Hassan Reddick, who I thought was, I'm not going to say a cute story, but a nice story going to the Senior Bowl and going to this season, you know, 1 year player, whatever, at Temple or whatever he was, now they're saying top 10. And I mean, that's as great as an example. If you want to talk to a kid who's going into his junior or senior season of college, and why do I have to go through with this? Why should I even bother? Like, that's the story. You can be making, you know, $22 million in 6 months if you really put it all together.
Okay. Well, let's talk who's made the biggest move in the last month.
Okay, so let me give you my top five, and then we'll go from who did the biggest move. Number, this is how I see it playing out Thursday, and bear with me if it's outdated by the time you listen to this. One, I do think Myles Garrett will ultimately be the pick, although I know a lot of people in the Cleveland front office really like Mitch Trubisky, and the argument from an economic standpoint is to take the quarterback if you like him. I think at the end of the day, cooler heads will prevail. They'll take Garrett, who is somehow the safer pick than the quarterback at this point. Two, Niners are going to hear a lot in the next 72 hours about Trubisky. I think just knowing the organization, knowing how they think, how they view this, I think Solomon Thomas out of Stanford will go number two. I think Jonathan Allen, the big defensive end out of Alabama, will go three to the Bears. Then I think Leonard Fournette goes four to the Jaguars. And then I think you get really silly after that. I think this is where you get trades and you get all sorts of talk and you get conjecture. And I think ultimately Tennessee will trade out of that five spot if they can, and someone moves up to get Trubisky. And I think that team might be the Cleveland Browns, trading up from the 12 spot to go up to top five. So they end up getting Garrett and Trubisky. And I think for them, if you're a fan of the Browns, that's the ideal situation. You get the quarterback and you also get the number one prospect in the draft.
Hey, Peter, just on this, because it's the Browns, if Mitch Trubisky grew up in the Pacific Northwest and is not an Ohio kid, like, is that at all, how much is that, if at all, impacting the Browns?
I want to say it doesn't help. Yeah, I want to say it doesn't help in his case, but it's hard not to get caught up in the majesty of it all. You know, he played in Mentor, Ohio. He's Mr. Ohio in high school. He grew up a Browns fan. But Browns fans at this point, like, look, Tom Brady's the most beloved Patriot of all time. He grew up in California. Like, at some point, it's the Brady Quinn story was nice. He's from Dublin, Ohio. It all made sense. Browns fan. At some point, it's like, just draft the best quarterback. Don't get caught up in the hometown story. It works for about a week until the guy stinks. And I would hope that with all these sabermetrics guys and all these, you know, football men, whether it be Greg Williams and Hugh Jackson, they don't get caught up in the headlines of local boy done good.
All right, so let me ask you, where you have two of the biggest stars in college football from the past couple of years, Deshaun Watson and Christian McCaffrey.
I've got Deshaun Watson my next guy off the board, going six to the New York Jets.
Wow.
I was really resistant. I was resistant of Watson because of such the negatives I was hearing right out of the gate. I was like, all right, this guy's the first quarterback, right? And everyone in the NFL was like, no. You don't understand. He threw 30 interceptions. He was surrounded by all pros everywhere. Like, this is – he does three passes. He does the fade. He does the post, and he does the little slant. That's all he's got. And then as these weeks have gone by, the pressure of getting a quarterback and writing your team, and now, wait a second, this guy went 28-2 and played his best two games against Nick Saban in the biggest of spots. I think he ends up going top 10. I think he goes to the Jets at six.
And then McCaffrey.
McCaffrey right after. I'm going eight to the Panthers. I don't think McCaffrey escapes the top 10. The only way he would is if Fournette was available to the Panthers at eight. They took Fournette, and then there's a kind of a scramble to see who can get McCaffrey. It kind of opens up wide open. But, guys, I know I'll give Klatt credit. I'll give you guys credit. Obviously, you know Christian McCaffrey for what he is. But Klatt way, way, way in the early was like, this guy is as good as Fournette, if not better. And, nice player, good. I thought he would go like 23 to the Giants in my first mock draft. But then he's been meeting with these teams. He doesn't work out with these teams. But he meets with him. He's amazing. His combine was amazing on his pro day. He worked out at wide receiver. He looked like he was, whatever it is, the next slot receiver, Victor Cruz or Julian Edelman, whoever you want to say. He looked as good as anybody at receiver that's coming out of this draft in that slot. So you're looking at 25 touches a game. You're looking at 10 carries, probably 8 to 9 pass attempts, and then 5 or 6 on special teams. That's a top 10 pick, guys.
Peter, you were actually the first person I heard to really jump on the table a few years ago for John Brown, super fast kid from Florida who ended up somewhere. What school did he go to? Was it like somewhere in the
Pittsburgh State?
Pittsburgh State, yeah, okay. You got one of those for us now?
Yeah, and I don't know him that well, but it's one of these guys. I'm doing the 7-round mock, and a few different guys in front office were like, "Well, you didn't include this guy," His name is Adam Shaheen out of Ashland. He's a tight end. I don't know much about him, but they're saying.
Oh, this is a big Daniel Jeremiah guy, right? He may be a second or third round.
I don't know.
Yeah, 6'6", 270, runs really well, has some good film. Yeah, I remember hearing him.
Of course you know that he's 6'6", 270. Of course.
Out of Ashland. Okay, he's a big one. I'm trying to think, give you another guy. There's a kid out of Villanova. I can't quite pronounce his name.
Tano Passanio. Tano Passanio.
You got it. They're saying he might go top 50. I mean, that's really high.
He looks the part. He definitely passes the eyeball test.
He's like 6'6", pass rusher, and that's really tempting to a lot of teams. And then you get your guys that – what's always surprising to me is the guy that didn't wow you in college necessarily, and then you see him, his name is like so high up. And we talked about Reddick as more of like the story like that. But then, some of these quarterbacks, it's okay to say the top 400, but like Davis Webb – who couldn't beat out, a couple guys. Mahomes, he couldn't beat out. I don't think he didn't beat out Baker Mayfield, but there was issues there. Mayfield.
No, he ended up beating Baker out. He got sick at the beginning. Baker started. Then when he got healthy, he overtook Baker, and he was the bowl MVP. Baker left. And then he got hurt, and he could not overtake Pat Mahomes when he got settled.
So he's going to go to Colorado, but then Goff goes pro. He says, screw it, I'll go to Cal. Long story short, I at no point in the college football season circled Davis Webb as a guy who would possibly go top 50, and now they're talking he might be the fourth, if not fifth, quarterback taken before even DeShone Kizer. And I'm like, gee, like Kizer was a Heisman, talk all last year. Davis Webb, and he's not from some small school. He's from a big school at Cal now, and he was playing at Texas Tech. So Davis Webb is another name that I think might go earlier than you might expect, and not a small school guy, but one of these names that you saw play in the Pac-12. I mean, I don't think anyone in the Big 12 or Pac-12, I'm not knocking the kid, but I don't think you were blown away and say that's the next great NFL quarterback. But there's a very good chance he's drafted a lot earlier than you might expect.
Stu, can we transition? Since Peter, I think you are the Hassan Reddick of NFL media. You are a guy who came out of Emory, was under the radar, kind of a home cooked guy, and now all of a sudden you are everywhere. You are hosting your own morning show on NFL Network that is wildly successful that was nominated for an Emmy, correct?
Thanks, Bruce. Yeah, it was nominated for an Emmy.
No, we're going to beat the drum for you.
This.
Yeah,
I like this. Go on. Yeah, you know, I want to hear it. I'll shut up and listen.
You are a sideline guy who has shown up all over the place. There's YouTube footage of you dancing at halftime all over the place.
Yep. At the Super Bowl with Carissa. Not a bad dance partner. I could do worse.
Yes. So on this crazy ride for you, and it's obviously not – it's just taking off, not ending soon – what has been the most surreal aspect of your career breakout in the last 18 months?
Well, here's the deal. Like, here's what I would say, and I appreciate you saying that. It means a lot. I'm almost 40. It's not like I'm like one of these kids where it's like, oh, I went viral on YouTube. Like I was not, you know, I was hammering away for years.
So you're the Garrett Bowles of this draft. Man.
Yes, I'm a 25-year-old offensive tackle who went to 5 schools and has been on a mission. Yes, that's who I am. I'm the Garrett Bowles of this. But no, I feel like, you know, I just kept my head down and worked hard, and I'm not, you know, and I think you guys are similar. I'm not a self-promoter. I don't necessarily have the most sensational Twitter feed, and like there are shortcomings with it, but along the way, the sidelines for Fox opened up doors for me to get in front of a lot of NFL people in a face-to-face setting, and that's my best setting. I'm better there than I am necessarily on social media or on radio interviews. So I got in those buildings doing production meetings. I have all gratefulness for Fox for giving me that opportunity. And then on the flip side, the NFL Network show, I get that, which is like a 1 in a million opportunity. And because I'm on the NFL Network every day for 6 hours a day in the morning, the people in the NFL see me there. So the exposure was built. So I'd like to think I do a good job, but I'm very grateful for the exposure and the opportunity. But damn, you guys know it's hard out there. And I was banging on the door for 10 years writing articles for FoxSports.com, working freelance, begging to be doing .com videos about the draft about 5-6 years ago. So here we are. It all has been working out. I've been knocking on wood, but you guys know. I mean, I've been reading you guys for the past decade, so it's not easy, and you just got to do really good work and be reliable.
I'll keep going. Maybe 10 years from now, I'll be sitting next to Kay Adams or, you know, the next Kay Adams. I don't know. But let's talk about this show for a second. Okay, Good Morning Football. You guys just went on the air, like it just started before last football season. And here you are.
Yeah, last July.
Here you are nominated for Outstanding Studio Show for the Sports Emmys. Let me read to you, Bruce, these other shows. You might be familiar with them. Pardon the Interruption. NFL Total Access. The Rich Eisen Show. MLB Tonight. And there's Good Morning Football. I mean, come on, man. This is huge.
It's cool. It's funny because here's the other thing to it. Like, we live in this very small bubble of like sports media and, you know, everything that FS1 does. Every time Jamie Harwich sneezes, there's an article on Awful Announcing, or there's a breakdown on, you know, one of the sites, or Richard Deitch is going to do a deep dive on ESPN's Tuesday morning rating. We're not a media darling, which is like the craziest thing about the Emmy nod. We didn't think we didn't deserve it, but we certainly didn't get the media love or the, you know. And this is nothing against anyone who does get that kind of coverage, but like none of us are being invited on Richard Deitch's podcast. None of us are getting profiles done by, you know, Awful Announcing or John Orand at the Sports Business Journal. We're not necessarily the cool crew at like The Ringer or Grantland. We're just kind of doing our show, and we almost do it for the four of us, like, and the producers. And along the way, we've gotten a nice little audience. It's pretty niche. It's NFL fans who don't want to hear other people screaming about the NBA at 7 in the morning. It's like, let's talk about the NFL and let's treat it like adults would. And it means the world. It's really cool. Like, it's a really cool nomination to get. Do I think we can win? Maybe. Would that be a big surprise? I think so. But to be nominated with PTI, like, I don't think I'm sounding too naive here. Like, that's pretty damn cool.
Peter, for the people who have seen the show, like a lot of things, I feel like, okay, this person's the star of the show or not. I mean, I know Kyle Brandt, who's one of your partners, who had been Jim Rome's guy for a while. But it's not like anyone say, okay, this is, you know, like you mentioned Rich Eisen, there's like the one person. Is it just kind of the show has had success because – Why do you think it has kind of really resonated with people?
I think we all have our own kind of role. So they, you know, credit to the company that produces it, Embassy Row and Michael Davies, who's the producer. But basically it's like Kay Adams, is our host and our fantasy expert. She does fantasy on the during the season on Saturdays and Sundays for DirecTV and is nails. I'll put her against all these other fantasy experts you see on ESPN. Burleson's an ex-player who says things, which I think we take it for granted. Like, what do you mean he says things? Well, a lot of times I've been on shows, and I think you guys have too, where the ex-player is hired as the ex-player, and it kind of ends there. Like, we push Nate to make a statement, you know, not try to cause headlines, but if you have a feeling, say it, and Nate does the work. So it's cool to get that from an ex-player in that situation. And then Kyle's kind of the voice of the fan, almost your Bill Simmons type, where it's like, here's how I see it. I'm not in the locker rooms. I can say whatever I want because I don't have to deal with these people. And then I'm your news and reporter guy. So we all have our own roles, but I think ESPN is launching like the Mike Greenberg Morning Show. And I was reading how they're going to promote it. It's like Mike Greenberg and his friends. It's almost disingenuous to say any of us would be that Mike Greenberg guy where it's like, it's me and my buddies. No, it's like the four of us. We're all pretty equal. And I think people tune in to watch the four of us talk. It's not like I come to hear Peter's information, but I can't stand the rest of the three. You know what I mean?
I come for the coffee mugs.
They're cool.
Yes. They make this. No, it's really, it is Pete. Your show comes on 4 a.m. Pacific, so I'd be lying if I've ever seen it live. But yeah. Fortunately, they play it again right after that. So so that's when I see it. It's really cool. Really happy for you. You know, we all cross paths a lot on the Fox lot for the various Fox shows over the past couple of years. So it's been really cool to see.
No, and it's like it means so much hearing it from you two because I feel like you guys too, like you're doing it on TV, you're doing it on web, like we're doing podcasts, like this is what we always want to do. And we were able to, in a way, and I think the listener at home can appreciate this, like you have to adapt. You got to change at a time. So in my early years in this career, I would have been happy and fine writing articles for FoxSports.com for the rest of my life. But in this day and age, like you need to be 360, you need to do as much as you can. And none of the three of us, I don't think so, were trained to be on television or be doing, you know, sports radio or any of this stuff, but we've kind of adapted, and it's really cool that the two of you guys have this podcast and obviously are all over the networks doing other shit too.
Bruce handed out the Big 12 championship trophy to Bob Stoops.
Yeah, think about that.
Where did that come from? Yeah.
You know what though? I think Peter's point is a good one. And a lot of times, and me being the oldest of the three of us here, we get these questions from students about, hey, you know, what advice would you give? And I feel like it's a really moving target, especially as the media climate has changed so much, especially just in the last 5 years. But I think it is very cool. And this is in all seriousness, you know, for to see you showing up in these big places is cool. Because I think, I don't want to say we're, you know, people are friends of you, know, you're very been supportive of us individually, but also you kind of live vicariously through that person you like, and you want to see them thriving and getting to do stuff. And I do think it's very interesting to see, you know, I give Fox a lot of credit because in my case, you know, I never would have thought I would have gotten the chance to do Silent or some of the stuff. And in your case, you know, you just keep popping up and doing stuff. And I think that's a good, it's inspiring, I think, for people to go, hey, this person, not because you make it look like anybody can do it, but I do think it gives people the chance to say, you know what, I could try this because even though I wasn't, you know, didn't go to school for this, that there's the opportunity for that. So
no,
my question out of that is, what is the thing that is the hardest thing about your job as it is now in 2017, whether it's to do sideline, that's a skill. To certainly, it feels like you guys are all hosting that show, getting in and out of breaks and everything to do that. Or just to manage the relationships and budget your time. What is the biggest challenge there?
Well, I'm still writing for FoxSports.com during the season, all my drafts. So I still do the podcast too. So, the thing that I think for me, and this is very specific to me, is that I'm on a 3-hour show on the NFL Network where we base a lot of our stuff on natural conversation and opinions, and you know, making a stand for something if you feel it's worth making a stand. If it's we're talking Jaguars, Titans, color rush uniforms. You don't have to try to make a headline and say something absurd. Like if you don't feel like you care that much, but you have this pressure to want to perform and entertain for 3 hours because it's not entertaining if I'm just reading the news and notes and the transactions. Like you've got to be creative, and that's Monday to Friday. And then I'll put on my hat and suddenly I'm Friday afternoon, I'm sitting with an NFL head coach, and maybe on Tuesday I was very critical of him or I was very critical of a player. you know, if Richard Sherman is popping his mouth off and I'm not happy with it and I say it, a very rare deal is where I'm in the studio Monday to Friday, but I'm also in the locker room on the weekends and I'm in the production meeting on the weekend. So I almost feel like with me, I've got to walk a line where it's, you better believe it, what you say, because you might have to face this person face to face, especially with the coaches and quarterbacks. So if I'm taking a crap all over Jay Cutler and I'm making fun of Jay Cutler and I'm saying Jay Cutler, you can't win with Jay Cutler, all this stuff. And then Sunday I've got Bears versus Packers and I'm meeting with Jay Cutler on Friday. There's a chance those words got back to him, or there's a chance he was walking through the facility and NFL Network was on and he saw it. Now this seems like first class problems. Like, oh, I'm worried about,
but that's unique. But that is unique to you. Like of all, almost all the other sideline reporters, none of them, are opinionists at some other point.
No, do you see Lisa Salters going off on First Take and saying, you know, why, you know, this is why Michael Bennett and Martellus Bennett are wrong for having comments on Trump? No, like you wouldn't. And maybe she does feel that way. And maybe I'm speaking out of line when I'm saying that, like, I've got this rare, this kind of weird deal, but I love that because it keeps me honest. I can't be a hot take guy and not believe in what I say because there's accountability and there's responsibility. And it almost makes what I say on Monday to Friday on the NFL Network show have more weight because the viewer knows that I deal with these people. Like, to me, the studio show stuff is interesting because a lot of guys say a lot of stuff, whether it be NFL or NBA and all this stuff, and they pop off and then they go to sleep and they show up on Monday morning and they go to work again. Unless it's a Super Bowl media opportunity where the guy is popping into the studio show, you never face him face to face. And even if you do, it's probably through the agent saying, hey, he was upset. All right, let's have him on the show. My deal is like, there's no safety net. And I've been critical. So I've had to face that. I've had to balance that. And I almost am proud of the fact that I haven't pulled any punches if I truly feel something. And on the flip side, if I do say something, I believe it. You know what I mean?
It's definitely, I haven't faced it quite to that extreme, but it's definitely something, if you're a reporter and you give your opinion places, and certainly on TV, like, you're not going to make it on TV very long if you don't say anything interesting. So, yeah, it's a unique pressure. I wonder if it's going to become a little more common because the line is blurring every year, even more so, right? Even like your beat writer for a team who has to see them every single day, you know, is sometimes expected to do these videos or on Twitter and actually give their opinions. And it's, the lines are blurred.
And you're right. And saying Russell Westbrook had 31 points and 11 assists, hey, I'm signing off, is different than saying, I think Russell Westbrook is being selfish and, they'd be better off if he passed more, you know, whatever it is. But like, there is an interesting gray area of how far I can go if I don't really believe it. And it's entertainment. And then it's also, okay, these are people's lives at stake. Not lives, careers at stake. That was ridiculous to say lives at stake, but careers at stake. And if I'm going to sully their name or if I'm going to drag them through the mud, like, you better be willing to back it up when you see them face to face.
Well, hopefully people know that you don't just say this stuff off the cuff. If you have an opinion, you probably did the research and the reporting and it comes from
somewhere. I got caught with one, and this is interesting. I want to hear what you guys think. And I know we're going on and on, but I hope the listeners of your podcast appreciate this candid conversation. But I was on, and it was a throwaway segment on our show. It was like NFC North overhaul, and it was the Packers, and it's the last segment of the hour, and I'm looking at the clock, and it's basically like, Peter, go through the Packers offseason. I said, all right, look, Jared Cook was really connecting with Aaron Rodgers. They were having a good connection, great chemistry, and then his agent, you know, basically she wanted a little more than what the Packers are willing to spend, and they ended up getting Martellus Bennett, and everyone's doing flips. And I sit on air and go, I'm not sure that that's an upgrade. You know, I thought Jared Cook had a pretty good year last year with Aaron Rodgers, and they had it clicking. And now you got to start with a new tight end, and it might be a downgrade. I say that. I say it with no fear, and I believe it. I totally believe it. Well, Martellus Bennett was watching and starts tweeting at the show, and he's like, tell Jonah Hill that, don't use the word downgrade. He's calling me Jonah Hill. And I'm thinking he's kidding. 2 days later, he's in Hawaii or something, and he's doing a Snapchat, and he's like, to everyone at the NFL Network who's questioning my abilities and, you know, you're on the list and all this stuff. And it's like, that's a wake-up call. People are watching. People are listening. You want to call somebody a downgrade, I don't care whether you believe it or not. Like, you're going to have to at least accept the fact they might not be thrilled with your opinion.
Knowing that, Peter, how often has it happened where there was some story or something, and maybe you know next week or a week from now, you may do this team, and you're like, you know what? I'm not going to weigh in on this on social media because I know either a PR guy or maybe this coach or certainly this player or his agent is keeping score, and I'll just let somebody else weigh in on this. I don't need to, like, echo the
I mean, I don't have that many enemies, and I don't think I really have that many scorching opinions where I'm going to really go over the line, like stuff like that. Or if I'm critical of an official, you know, and I call him out by name on the show, and I'll get a note from someone saying, maybe you don't need to, you know, it's not from the league, but it's from other people around the league saying, you know, you need to call out the official's name on television 7 times. Like, you learn, you know, people watch, but very rarely. I mean, Bruce, if I think it, I'll say it. I'm not really scared. I think everyone can appreciate that we're on television doing a job, and to just sit there sitting on my hands wouldn't do anybody any good.
All right. Well, as fun as this is, we do actually need to wrap it up, believe it or not.
Let's do it.
I saw you're going to be covering the draft. You're going to be on NFL Network during the draft, right?
Yeah, day two. So we're talking our Davis Webb, Nathan Peterman point of the draft. I will be at a table, and I'll be talking NFL Network, my thoughts and what I'm hearing about those guys.
All right, so we've already rattled off about 8 different places. You can see our guest here, Peter Schrager. Anything we forgot?
No, Twitter, PSCHRAGS. I love both of you guys. You've always been so good to me. And last time we did this, last year this time, we got a lot of good feedback on the podcast. Hopefully listeners enjoy it, and thank you for having me. It really means a lot.
Peter, thanks for taking the time. We asked you for 15 or 20 minutes. I think you gave us 40, and we probably could have kept you longer. So
boom.
Enjoy Philly, and we will follow you on Twitter and keep up with you on all your various platforms.